There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Actress Susan Sarandon has received an Academy Award as Best Actress for her film portrayal of Sister Helen Prejean. Carol Boss interviewed the real Sister Helen Prejean.
Sister Helen Prejean is the author of Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty in the U.S. It's a moving, personal account of a complex and troubling ethical issue. Dead Man Walking is what the guards at San Quentin used to shout when an inmate took his last long walk to the gas chamber. Sister Helen Prejean, a Roman Catholic nun in Louisiana, has traveled a long road from her first encounter with a death row inmate in 1982 to being at the forefront of a crusade to end the death penalty in America. For 13 years, she's been a source of compassion and hope for both the men on death row and the families of their victims. I had the opportunity to talk to Sister Helen when she visited New Mexico.
Well, I'm a Southern girl. I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, a very close family, Catholic family. Daddy a lawyer, Mama a registered nurse. I have a brother and sister. And lived in a nice home and went to a private Catholic school. It was during the days of segregation in Louisiana, which I never questioned. We had black servants. Then when I finished high school, had great nuns. Full of humor and warmth, and I kind of always sensed that there was a way maybe I could give my love that wouldn't be to marry one man, have one little family. And I became a sister with great support of my family because our family was deeply religious. Cried all the way to New Orleans where I entered the novitiate, because when you entered religious life in those days and became a nun, it was really entering a cloister. You didn't eat in front of people after that. I thought I'd never be again in my family home. I was really leaving my family. But there was, you follow a current, it's like your boat is on a little current. And I've been following that little current all my life. And so became a Sister St. Joseph, went through the training, long hours of silence and prayer and penance, and then became a teacher. Always knew I wanted to be a teacher. Still feel like I'm a teacher. And then our sisters in the 70s, you know, the whole civil rights movement and so forth, there was a lot of discussion, and especially through our sisters from Latin America, about where our place really ought to be, where our ministry should be, because religious orders, by and large, moved up with the immigrant church, and as immigrant Catholics got to be more affluent, moved more and more with affluent people. So there was a call to get back to poor and struggling people, which I did. And then I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Projects, the Black Inner City Housing Project in 1981, and there a whole new adventure began for me.
Can you talk about becoming a social activist?
Well, first of all, the connection of my faith with justice and the working for justice. Part of the theology, I think, that I learned as part of my earlier faith was one that in union with God, love of God, to be holy, to be prayerful, and to be charitable to the poor. But it never brought me into direct contact with the poor. And connecting faith to justice meant that I began to look at the Gospels in a new way, that you look and see who were the people Jesus associated with the most. I mean, like we just celebrated Christmas. We have all these little cribs, and they say, oh yeah, Jesus was born because there was no room for him in the inn, and shepherds came and all that. And shepherds of that day were known as thieves, and they were the unclean and the unwashed, and people didn't like to associate with shepherds. Now in these little cribs, we have all these little shepherds and the star of Bethlehem and all that. And who was he with? You know, he was with people who were considered sinners. Yeah, he would touch lepers. And I began to see, well, I'm not in touch with people who are really poor and struggling. I'm not with people in the housing projects. I'm not with people in prison. So it's like once I got the connection that part of following Christ was going to where the poorest, most suffering people were, a whole new aspect of my faith came alive. And it has a vibrancy in it, which I feel today. Because when you start living among and being among people who are really poor and struggling, you have to draw your sources of power, first of all, from each other. You become dependent on community in a whole new way. If you have all kind of resources and a big bank account, you can do individualistic things. When you're up against big things, like undoing racism in this country, or working for just wages for people and jobs, or as it unfolded for me soon to get into the whole prison thing and the death penalty and people executed, you got to draw on some powers deeper than yourself. You're very involved yourself, but it's beyond ego and individualism. It's like only we can do this together. And so it draws out of you powers and things. Like I began to speak, I began to write. A lot of my gifts, I think, came to the fore because they were needed. Somebody's got to articulate this, because most people live in little cocoons or terrariums. I read a statistic not long ago that 83% of white people in this country live in neighborhoods where there's less than 1% people of color. We still have deep segregation patterns. I heard the most segregated day of the week in America is Sunday, that churches follow those patterns of segregation. And so to me, the call of the gospel of Jesus in all of its new vibrancy was, look, we are all one. And the way it's possible to execute people or send them to prison or let them live in ghettos and all is a dissociation. And the dissociation basically means they are foreigners and they are not human like us, so they don't suffer like we do, or they're not as responsible as we are, they're lazy or they're this. And that dissociation, which of course happens especially with people on death row, we have an image of them as a monster or not human. And the building of the human family, an integral part of that journey means, like, I'm a bridge builder between people. I go and I say, wait, I was with this person. Let me tell you about this person. And you make them human. And that's what I tried to do in my book, Dead Man Walking, where I told about my experiences with death row inmates and executions.
How did you first get involved with death row inmates?
Well, you know, Carol, is like a greased track. When you get involved with the poor, it's only a matter of minutes before you're involved with people in prison, because especially in Louisiana, well, all over this country, the poor are sent to prison. That's our way of dealing with poor people. There's a huge disproportionate number of poor people who get sent to prison. And some people say, yeah, that's because poor people are committing all the crimes, they do more violence. To some extent, that has become true since the late 70s. But by and large, once you start learning about the criminal justice system, you see that the going to prison, and especially going to death row, has everything to do with what kind of legal resources you have. So anyway, moving into the St. Thomas Projects, the mamas would say, our boys leave here either in a hearse or a police car, the violence, people killed, or going off to prison. So I'm working at a place called Hope House in an adult learning center, people coming back to get their high school diplomas, and right around the corner from where I was working was the Louisiana Coalition on Jails and Prisons. And one day, a friend of mine, it was a very casual thing. He was coming down the street, he had a little clipboard, had a little project going. Anybody he was going to see that day, he'd ask him. And he saw me and he said, hey, Sister Ellen, he said, would you be a pen pal to somebody on death row? I want to, like, hook them up at least with people to write to them. And I said, sure. And I had no idea when I said that. He wrote the guy's name down in this envelope for me, Patrick Sonia. And I had no idea where that was going to take me, you know. I thought I'd write him some letters and he'd write me letters back, and that's all it was going to be. That's how it got started.
So will you tell us about the evolution of your relationship with Pat Sonia?
Well, first of all, you know, the writing of the letter, I didn't undertake it lightly. I figured he didn't need somebody who would give him a whole swarm of letters and then not be consistent. So when I wrote him the first letter, I said, I just want you to know, I just care about your life and believe that your life has value and dignity, and I'm going to keep writing even if you don't write back to me, you know. And then like a week later, the letter came, Dear Sister Helen, I couldn't believe it when the guard stopped by my cell and said, hey, Sonia, you got a letter, because I knew I wasn't writing to anybody, he said, because I know they're going to kill me, and I feel it's better to go it alone. But he said, it's been just too hard, and I'd like to be your pen pal. So I'd write him about what was going on at Hope House, and he would write me about life in a 6-foot by 8.5-foot cell, and how he would use his foot locker as a lift to build up his arms, and how many paces there were in the cell, and how you had to walk sideways between your bunk and this metal thing that came out that was supposed to serve as a desk, and just all the stuff about his life. And then I realized he had no one to come see him, par for the course, as I found out, of most people on death row. Prisons are often in way out of the way places. In Louisiana State Penitentiary in Louisiana, we have over 5,000 people who are incarcerated there, long-term sentences. Half of them have never received one visit or one postcard from anybody. And then, of course, I'm reading the Gospels in a new way, too. I mean, where before I would interpret things figuratively, I was in prison and you came to me, I was hungry and you gave me to eat, now I was beginning to do those things. So it was just real clear he had no one to come and see him. It was too hard on his mama. She had been emotionally distraught ever since the crime had happened. And plus, it was really hard for mamas to go into a building where the sign over their son's house says death row, condemned row, where people are trying to kill their children. It's very difficult for them even physically to go to the place. So consequence, many people, families, it was difficult to visit, it was hard to visit, and they stayed away, and that was the case of Patrick, so I went to see him. And in Dead Man Walking, I take people through all of this. I mean, I tried to write it like you'd write a good novel, in the sense of just bringing people there and showing the details of it. Like, it's scary the first time you go into a prison. I don't know about all prisons. The Louisiana prison was scary, because they had this big green sign when you go into the visitor room, that by stepping onto prison property, you subject yourself to body searches and dog sniffing and body cavities. I stopped reading the daggone sign. I said, oh, God, you know. And then I thought, well, maybe they'll cut me slack because I'm a nun, you know, and think I won't be bringing drugs in here, but it's scary. And then I just talk about how this guard brought me to this visit on death row. It kept clanging these gates behind me. I said, when are we going to get to this place? Clang one gate, clang another gate. You go deep into the prison, and then I rounded a corner, and then there was a green metal door with these little barred window, and above it these red block letters that said death row, and behind there were the tiers where 45 people are kept waiting to be executed unless their lives are saved in the courts. And then they locked me in a room to wait for Pat. And then I heard him coming, and I heard the chains on his legs. I had seen animals chained. I had never seen chains on human beings before. And ironically, that sound of the chains on that floor would be one of the last sounds I would remember, because when they led him to the electric chair, I remember how the chains on his legs dragged across that tile floor in the death house. He came, and he had a leather belt around his waist, and his hands were handcuffed to the leather belt, so he couldn't move his hands up and down much, you know, like he was smoking a cigarette, and he'd have to lean his head way over to... And he was so glad to see me. He was all shaved, and his hair was combed, and he hadn't had a visitor, and I don't know when. And the fact that somebody had come to see him. There's so many deadening effects on the human spirit in a prison. One of them is that you're nothing. You don't count. You have a number. Nobody ever comes to see you. And you get a million signals a day, especially like on death row, that you are disposable human trash. And so a visit just is so uplifting to the human spirit, because somebody has driven all this way to come see you. And he was so grateful. I mean, Patrick Saunier, and I had been warned, Helen, you naive about all this stuff. You know, this person's going to try to con you. He's going to tell you all kind of wonderful things and how he's found God and all that. And then next thing you know, he's asking you for money because he wants to get cigarettes. He never asked me for anything. One time I found out that he could only listen to music in his cell if he had earphones on. They wouldn't allow everybody to play their radios. And I sent him some earphones. I went to Radio Shack and got him some. And I remember I got the letter from him saying, I listened to music all night. But he never would ask me, and he was always grateful. Toward the end, some of the last words before he died was, thank you for showing me love. I don't think the man had ever received any kind of unconditional love in his life. So we visited for 2 hours, and he did most of the talking, actually. I was just, this poured out life from this man was coming, and I was listening, and he knew that I cared, and we began that way. And then I set up a rhythm of writing to him in between, and then visiting him. He didn't mention the crime. I figured it's not my place to ask him to confess to me the worst thing he ever did in his life, that if he ever trusted me enough, he would tell me that. But I also didn't want to be naive. I said, I know he's not here on death row because he's been a real good Boy Scout, and I wanted to deal with that part too. So I went to the Prison Coalition office. This is after several months of visiting him. He was on death row, and his brother was serving a life sentence. Right away I thought, there's been a murder. One got death and one got life. I had no idea how the criminal justice system worked and how often that happens, and the way that that happens. Like when you have two co-defendants and there are no other witnesses, if one gives state's evidence against the other, they reduce his sentence for doing that. So how much of the truth gets negotiated from square one in this process? And when there are pressure, social pressure on DAs to get somebody, there's great pressure on them to say, well, we're not sure which one of them did it, but we're going to get one of them. And so you have some people going to death and some people getting life, and it's not always that clear at all that the one receiving the death sentence is the one who actually killed the person. But anyway, I go over to the Prison Coalition office, and I just said, you know, I want to just get a little background on this Sonia case. I'm visiting him. And so they said, sure. And it was an October day, I remember, and toward the evening, because I remember how red the sun was. And they were leaving the office, and they said, here, and they stack all these manila envelopes on this table for me to read. And they left, and they said, look, just when you leave, close the door. So I was in there alone. And now I'd gotten to know this man. I'd been writing to this man, and I knew he had goodness in him. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind that there was goodness in this man, you know. And to be in his presence was the experience that every human being is more than the worst thing we ever do in our life. There's a transcendence in human beings and a dignity. I knew that part. That part was solid in me. And then I opened the manila folder. I remember thinking, terrible knowledge. Sometimes you receive knowledge and you are never the same again once you know this. Because when I opened the folder, there were newspaper clippings from the New Iberia. New Iberia is right in the middle of Acadiana in Louisiana. You got New Iberia and Lafayette and St. Martinville, all these little villages and towns where the Acadians are. And there, it's associated with joie de vivre, the joy of life, and good eating, and the zydeco dancing, and then to see on the front pages of this newspaper this picture of this beautiful young boy and girl, Loretta Bork, 18 years old, David LeBlanc, 17 years old, in their little prom outfits. And next to them, the scowling, sinister, terrible-looking pictures of Pat Saunier and his brother, and the headline, Teenage Couple Killed. And then the account of the murder, the children, the young people had been found lying face down near this sugar cane field. They'd been shot in the back of the head. The girl had been raped. And the stories of how these two brothers had been other teenage couples who had been abducted from that area. There was a little lover's lane near a sugar cane field outside of St. Martinville, and the kids had been parked there after a football game on a Friday night, November 4th, 1977. And then to read the description of how Pat and Eddie Saunier would take these kids and say, hey, y'all are trespassing here. They pose as security officers. And then that would lead to, well, we're going to have to go tell the owners that you all are trespassing. And then that would go, well, look, if the girl has sex with us, we won't report on you. And, you know, abducting kids and coercing kids and raping young women. But it had never turned to murder. Well, this night it did. And to read an account of that, and I thought, oh, my God. There were a lot of things in my soul went on at the same time. One was, God, these poor parents. It's every parent's worst nightmare that your children go out and they don't come home. So the parents, in a way, were put on death row for the rest of their lives. The universe could never be benign to them again. Their whole faith in God Because, like, you see pictures like, God is our good shepherd, God is our protector, God is the one who loves us, God is the one who keeps us from harm. And to let our children die in such a terrible way, would their faith be shattered in God? And I thought, well, maybe I ought to go see them. Then partly it was cowardice, partly it was confusion of, well, maybe if I don't believe in the death penalty, what if I get there? And they say, Sister, you really care about us and the loss of our child. We want to see this person executed. And if you love us, you want to see him executed too. And I knew there was still a strong part of my soul that I didn't believe that the state of Louisiana, that governments, should imitate violence and kill people who kill to try to show that killing's wrong. Such a profound moral contradiction. And that part was firm in my soul. But then the other side, it was a kind of guilt. God, I've been befriending this guy. By then I was visiting his brother as well. It was almost like you have to choose sides. If you befriend these people and you believe in their humanity and their dignity and all, you're going up against the victim's family. It's profound tension. In the Gulf of Mexico, when the deep green waters meet the shallow waters, it forms a riptide. There's a little line of foam, and I think a riptide formed in my soul of holding on the one hand that the state shouldn't be executing, and then on the other side, grief with the victims and compassion for them and wanting to do anything that would take away their pain. Like if they say, I want him to be executed, say, yeah, I want him to be executed too, because you know you could be in solidarity with him in something. And I stayed away from them because I wasn't sure. And it was a big mistake. I met those victims' families at the pardon board hearing for Pat Sonnier right before he was executed. And by the time you reach a pardon board hearing, things are at high pitch in terms of the polarization in the sides, because the family of Pat Sonnier and his friends would go before the pardon board and say, let him live. The victims' families are there at the DA's office and say, we demand his death. Look what we had suffered. It's an incredible experience to go to a pardon board hearing. And then these political appointees of a governor, not chosen for their ethics and their compassion and their deep morality, but political appointees, then weigh this and make decisions. And part of what I do in Dead Man Walking Too is expose the corruption of the pardon board that's been in Louisiana, and I presume in pardon boards all across this country, because their marching orders are to do the will of the governor who appointed them to the office. And so whatever his stand is becomes theirs too, and it's got nothing to do with hearing these cases and dispensing clemency. It's the last part of the divine right of kings that governors have to give life or to take it away. You know, like the emperor in the amphitheater, you know, like thumbs up they live, thumbs down they die. It's incredible when you think that we still have that at play in our society. At the pardon board hearing, when the pardon board went to vote on whether or not Pat would live or die, we were walking on the sidewalk outside, and that's when I met the victims' families. The Bork family, whose daughter was murdered, was very angry. They didn't even want to talk to me because I had spoken for Pat to live and for the state not to execute him. But I was not prepared for Lloyd LeBlanc. Lloyd and Eula LeBlanc, their son David, was murdered. And Lloyd LeBlanc, Cajun, he says, "May sister, may all this time," deeply Catholic, of course, in their DNA molecules, people are Catholic in Louisiana. And he said, "May sister, all this time you've been visiting with Pat and with his brother, you didn't come see me and you." He said, "May, I got all this pressure on me," because see, Louisiana allows the victims' families to witness execution. Lloyd LeBlanc didn't want to do that. He asked his brother to be the witness. His brother had a heart attack. He was on a grease track on this thing, and he didn't want to be there. But I got to him too late. It was a terrible thing to realize that if I could have been visiting with him and helping him and supporting him, I could have maybe saved him from watching Pat Sonnier die, which just ripped him apart. He didn't want to see another man die. He wanted an apology. But he, if there's a hero in Dead Man Walking, it's this man, because he overcame all the rage and the revenge so that it wouldn't destroy him. You know, some people think forgiveness is a weak thing. They interpret forgiveness meaning, oh, it doesn't matter that my son got killed. I condone it. It's okay. That's not what forgiveness means. Forgiveness comes from the words to give before, which means that you wall off that hatred and you don't let it take over you. And I meet them. And he said, well, you never came to see me. Well, it changed my soul from ever after there, that whenever I took someone on death row, I always approached the victim's family. But anyway, so Lloyd LeBlanc, but then in Dead Man Walking, I tell his story and the struggle to overcome and what murder victims' families go through. I began to go to Parents of Murdered Children's meetings. I began to listen to them. You know what shocked me the most about them was not so much that they felt abused by the criminal justice system and the DA's office wouldn't call them and tell them when the court thing was. Because DA's offices are not prepared to help people through the whole grieving process. Their training is all in going to get the criminal, bringing them to punishment, you know. But what shocked me the most about murder victims' families was how many of them said that they were left alone by their friends, by their church, because people didn't know how to deal with their pain. I mean, there were people who said, I try to bring up about my daughter, and people change the subject. Or sometimes people even say insensitive things like, well, Mary, don't you think you really ought to be past that by now? So it came to the whole thing that murder victims' family really need help. And part of the faith community should be, any church, any synagogue, should be a group to reach out to people of violence to help that healing process. Part of the healing process for people who have undergone a terrible violence is to be in a group of people who are present there and who care about you and allow you to tell the terrible details of what happened. Because only by getting that out over and over again can it finally, like, be spent, and then you can let it go. And what people were saying is if they would go to talk about it, people would put their hands up or change the subject or simply not come and see them, just stay away from them. So there's a great need, and it is growing in this country, you know, of forming support groups for victims' families so that they can work through their guilt, parents especially. The divorce rate is over 70% of parents who lose children, whatever fault lines are in the marriage. When they undergo a huge loss like this, traumatic loss, it puts a strain on the marriage. They have different ways of grieving, and the marriage breaks apart. So I gradually got more and more involved with murder victims' families and tell their stories in Dead Man Walking as well.
So what was that last night like right before his execution?
When I think of it, you know, I didn't know when I wrote that letter that that was going to be a passport. That name on that envelope, Patrick Soni, was a passport into this strange country. See, the death penalty is a ritual. It's worked out, and guards practice. The strap-down team, whose job it is to kill the person, practice. They meet with prison officials and the prison psychiatrists who assure them that they're just carrying out their job. They're not personally responsible for the death of a fellow human being. And I wanted to tell their story, too, in Dead Man Walking, because I believe politicians are the only ones benefiting from the death penalty because they can use it as a simple formula, supposedly that it's tough on crime. And they get away with that.
Sister Helen Prejean spoke to Carol Boss in 1995 at Community Radio KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Her book, Dead Man Walking, inspired a film, an opera, and a movement. She is still campaigning. Next week on Wings, Sister Helen talks about workers on death row, public opinions, racism, and the courts. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to all Wings supporters, especially Genevieve Vaughn, author of Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.